Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Henry Strozier, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled The Basics of Genetics. Your professor is Betsy Dexter Dyer of Wheaton College. Professor Dyer teaches courses on such subjects as bacteriology, genetics, parasitology, and invertebrate evolution. She earned her Ph.D. in biology at Boston University in 1984. Dyer's research interests include DNA sequence analysis, cell evolution, symbiosis, and field microbiology. Dyer considers herself to be a curious naturalist and a generalist, with lots more to learn. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites and a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students. And now we begin The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 1, The Long History of Practical Genetics. And now, Professor Dyer.
This is a course on basic genetics, and genetics is the study of how the traits of organisms are inherited. It can range all the way from simple observations, including observations that you make yourself about how traits seem to get inherited, all the way to complex explanations requiring an understanding of how DNA works. And DNA is the information molecule by which traits are encoded and passed along from organism to organism. Genetics is one of my favorite courses to teach. I think I love it for a number of reasons. One is that it really keeps me on my toes. There's always something new in genetics, and I really enjoy keeping up to date on it. But I also really love the basics and fundamentals of genetics. And I think it may come from my having grown up on a farm with a great many animals and plants around me who were, in fact, reproducing. The barn cats were having kittens. The cattle were having calves. I kept guinea pigs and had lots of baby guinea pigs to look at. And as a child growing up, future scientist, I was an avid amateur naturalist, collector of butterflies, collector of rocks, an observer of nature, birds. I ended up in with some of the interests that later sustained me as a scientist. But one of the things that I always found challenging, difficult, even when I asked adults about it, was how come the kittens looked the way they did, given how the mother looked, given what we might be able to think about what the father looked like? How come puppies looked the way they did, given what the parents looked like? How come my guinea pigs ended up looking the way they did, given what the parents looked like? Or the various cattle, especially since we had varieties of different colors. And as a curious child, I looked into that a little bit and found the explanations for the genetics intimidating. And one of my goals for my students at Wheaton, and one of my goals for you, is to get a little more relaxed with what some of the basic rules are and maybe a little more conversant with how those things happen. How does an orange and black cat manage to have black and white kittens? How did my gray and orange guinea pigs manage to have offspring that were white in some cases? You know, what was going on with the genetics? And why was it so difficult in what few books I might have tried to read? Why was it so difficult to explain what was going on with the genetics? This really basic practical thing. So it's my goal in this course to take you through some of my favorite examples. When I'm working with my students at Wheaton College, we work on fruit flies. I'll talk about fruit flies a little bit. But I really enjoy mammalian genetics, and I'm going to use a lot of dog and cat examples as well as bringing around some human examples. This course is going to focus mostly on the basics, the simple rules and patterns for how traits are passed down from organism to organism, and then exceptions to those rules, which actually make them so much more interesting, exceptions to those patterns, and then we will actually get into some of the complexities of gene activities, and then into the many activities of DNA, an absolutely amazing molecule. About halfway through the course, we'll get to DNA and talk about it quite a bit. The goals for this course are for you to get a firm foundation in those basics, so that you will be better able to understand some of the major current research in genetics, the sort of thing that we hear about in the news, the sort of thing that sometimes we're called upon to have opinions for, whether or not we have basics in genetics. So the goal here is to get some of those basics, to get a firm foundation so that you can then move on from that and look at some more complicated things. Another goal is to make this accessible in a way that perhaps you don't typically think about genetics. That is, some of these things you can try at home. Some of these things you can try via some assignments that I'm going to give you. And here and there, I'll have suggestions for discussions that you might want to have. Obviously, we're not getting together as a class in this format, but certainly you can have your own version of class discussions by having interesting new topics to talk about. So how far back are we going to start with this course? I want to start back with the deepest roots that I can think of, thousands of years ago, to the roots of agriculture, because essentially agriculture is nothing much more than practical genetics. When our human ancestors made the transition from hunting animals and gathering plants to manipulating animals and plants and arranging their reproduction and monitoring that reproduction and making adjustments, they were on their way to domesticating animals and plants, and they were on their way the world over thousands of years ago to the beginnings of agriculture. They essentially took wild species of animals and plants and domesticated them by very, very carefully understanding as best they could what was going on with the passage of traits from parent to offspring. How successful were they? Extremely successful. What's the evidence for their success? You only have to consider what we have now for the huge varieties of domesticated animals and plants. Think of all the grains of the world upon which the world essentially depends. We could not have the population of the world as it is without domesticated grains. Think of rice, think of corn, think of wheat. All of those have their wild counterparts, which made far fewer seeds. It's the seed part of the grain, of course, that we eat. Far fewer seeds, tinier seeds, less nutritious seeds, and now corn, wheat, and rice, evidence of the manipulation of the genetics of those crops, are what sustain the world. Think of something like apples. They begin as tiny, sour, wild apples, and now think of all the varieties we have. And then my favorite example that we'll dwell on over and over again in this course, dogs. Look at the varieties of dogs that our human ancestors manipulated and bred and monitored and essentially developed using genetic techniques. And just for fun here, I've looked at a list of dogs just to look at those that have place names in their breed names. So here's a list that just goes partway through the letter C, because I don't want to take up too much time doing something that you could do yourself. We have Afghan hounds developed by ancestors in Afghanistan. We have Alaskan Malamutes. We have Brittany's developed in Brittany. We have Bernese Mountain Dogs. We have Cardigan Welsh Corgis. We have Chinese Crested Dogs. We have Clumber Spaniels developed in the British Isles. So here's your first assignment. Do this with dog breeds. Consider doing it with cats or horses or goldfish or fancy mice or fancy pigeons or chickens or sheep. Go to the library or go to your own bookshelf. Get a big book full of pictures of the varieties of breeds of these animals, your choice of what you want to choose, and just notice and be amazed at how successful genetics has been already. And notice not only the shapes and sizes of whatever organism you choose, But notice the varied functions. If it's sheep, you might have sheep bred for meat, sheep bred for wool, sheep bred for wool of a particular texture. If it's dogs, of course, you've got herding dogs and guarding dogs and hunting dogs. But our human ancestors went even beyond that. They also went into the realm of beauty. Look at how beautiful some of these organisms are. They weren't simply breeding for function. And the evidence is right there in whatever book you choose to look at for varieties of breeds. I also want you to notice, too, the varieties of plants that are accessible to us and that are evidence for how successful our ancestors were with genetics. And I want to suggest one particular family or group of plants that you can access easily in the grocery store or in the garden. They're sometimes called the brassicas. They also, I'm going to give you the other name for them in case you're looking them up in an older book. They also can be called the cruciferous plants, C-R-U-C-I-F-E-R-S, crucifers or cruciferous plants. That's a slightly old-fashioned name for them. They are also called the mustard family, and they are all derived from a little plant or a little group of plants called the wild mustards. And I'm going to assign you also to take a peek at what a wild mustard looks like. But first, let's go to the grocery store, or let's go to an extensive garden that grows a variety of things. Here are all of the brassicas, or a fairly long list of the brassicas that you can see. Broccoli, broccoli rabe, which if you look in the grocery store, you'll see is different from broccoli. Brussels sprouts. And if you noticed as a child that Brussels sprouts look like little tiny cabbages, well, you're right. They are little tiny cabbages that just happen to grow in strange clusters on a stem. So Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, Chinese cabbage, kale, mustard. And when you think mustard, think not only the green herb that you might use in a salad, but also mustard seeds. Sometimes we use mustard for other parts of the plant. Mustard seeds, of course, giving us mustard that you would use as a condiment. Radishes, Swiss chard, turnips. Isn't that an amazing list? I mean, what's left in the grocery store when we're done with that list? Well, other interesting families, actually. But so here's your first assignment. Go, or here's your second assignment after you've examined a book of dog or sheep or chicken breeds. Go and compare and contrast in the grocery store and be amazed at what our ancestors the world over have done with the brassicas. And while you're at it, take a look at what wild mustards and wild radishes look like in your particular area. How are you going to do that? Get a wildflower book, look up wild mustard, look up wild radish, and if you do nothing more than look at the picture, that will be significant. Look at that spindly little skinny plant with the little tiny leaves and the little tiny inconsequential flowers and seeds, and there's your evidence right there at the extraordinary things that our ancestors did with that particular little wild weed. Think about beauty, too. You have permission to go to a floral shop and consider it an assignment for this course and be amazed at what our human ancestors have done with colors and shapes and scents of flowers, with no particular practical application, at least not in the sense that we usually think of for vegetables. Okay, so what did our ancestors understand about the underlying mechanisms for the genetics of all of this wonderful activity? Nothing. I would say nothing, or almost nothing. What they had was a great deal of persistence. They had some good guesses. They also had a few thousand years in many cases, so that some mistakes, I'm sure, occurred, and things eventually happened the way we end up seeing them. But basically, it was persistence and good guesses, and really a lot of vigilance with culling out or removing those organisms that they did not want to have reproducing, preventing breeding, encouraging breeding of other organisms. They also probably encountered plenty of surprises. And I'm going to divide their surprises into two categories. One kind of surprise is, let's say that you're trying to get dogs with shorter legs, for some reason. And actually, of course, there are breeds of dogs with shorter legs, and they can go down rabbit holes and get into small spaces and go after rodents, et cetera. So there are all kinds of reasons our ancestors might have been breeding for dogs with much shorter legs, like dachshunds, for example. Well, what you're really doing is breeding for skeleton and muscle differences, right? Those little legs have got to have skeleton and muscle tissues in there. What our ancestors probably were surprised at over and over again was how some negative traits can come right along with those supposedly positive traits. That is, if you're busy trying to get the legs of a dog much, much shorter over the course of many generations, selecting and breeding and selecting only for those dogs with the shortest legs, there could be other skeletal deformities and other muscle problems, maybe circulation problems that could go hand in hand. So that would be one category of surprise that our human ancestors had to deal with as they were manipulating the breeding of their organisms. And it's still the sort of surprise that we encounter today. Breeding of racehorses, for example. Longer legs, stronger muscles, but sometimes what goes hand in hand with that are more fragile legs and more likely to have accidents at the track. Another category of surprise that our ancestors must have encountered over and over again was the sudden, not gradual, but sudden appearance of birth defects, either lethal or not. And we know, we can go back in the literature and see that these were called monsters. It's one of the original uses of the word monster. That is, these surprise, amazing, completely different-looking organisms in some cases, and in some cases, the condition would be lethal. It must have been a real challenge for our human ancestors to try to rationalize and find causes for these things, to try to find the patterns, essentially. Humans tend to be great pattern finders, great rationalizers. And so out of this, you can find all sorts of superstitions and even religious beliefs concerning what was going on, especially with sudden appearances of birth defects. You know, perhaps the gods were angry, or perhaps this organism had had something strange in its environment that had caused this. So it's not that humans were reluctant to try to rationalize and figure this out. They were very eager to do so. But the underlying genetics was something that I think I'm safe in saying nobody fully understood until we get to the late part of the 19th century. How about humans? Well, humans have been very busy over the course of thousands of years, maybe longer, in manipulating and arranging and monitoring and adjusting the matings of humans too. Think of arranged marriages. Think of simply choosing a mate. Based on what? Based on their intelligence, based on their strength, based on their beauty, whatever the standard of beauty is for your particular group of people. So humans, too, have done amazing things with the manipulation of their own genetics. And the consequences are regional appearances of humans, which used to be much, much stronger because of limited travel options. We're thinking of thousands and thousands of years of human history, of course. Limited travel options, limited mate choice if you're living in a very small area. And thus we get all of the varieties of humans that we see on Earth. And even though today it's fairly commonplace for people in developed countries to get around the world, there are still many, many groups of humans that actually do not travel all that much away from the places of their origin. We will talk a little bit more about that. I'm going to do quite a bit with dog genetics, but in genetics, we typically have what we call model organisms, organisms that we seem to dwell on for some particular sort of example. And you should feel free to extrapolate to other examples. In other words, just because I'm doing dog genetics doesn't mean it couldn't apply to cat genetics or horse genetics or human genetics. And as we're going along, I'll remind you of that so that you can make the connections. It's not so much that dog genetics is pivotal in any way, except that I think it's an especially accessible example and that will be useful for this course. By the way, continuing along a little bit with human genetics, here's some additional evidence for how interested our human ancestors were. We have extensive vocabularies in all languages for relatedness. second cousin, cousin removed, great-great-grandfather, uncle, uncle by marriage, uncle who's actually related to me. So this I think, is indicative of just how important this has always been for our human ancestors. The keeping of records of ancestries has also been important, whether they've been written records or oral records. There are many records of pedigrees that are in an oral tradition, absolutely amazing oral traditions. And then, of course, all sorts of rules and regulations about marriages, including who you can marry, who you cannot marry, and all sorts of arrangements for that. And the consequences have been interesting. Not only do we get the varieties of people around the world, as I said, but we also have the same surprising consequences that I was talking about for the breeding of animals. That is, there are some surprise regional traits. Typically, we focus on diseases. That is, there are some particular genetic diseases associated with certain regional types of humans. And there are certain surprise birth defects that can be associated with certain regional types of humans. In other words, this had the same sort of consequences and the same sorts of surprises and unexpected results occasionally that we have seen for the development of animals and plants. So if I could be so bold as to say this, I would say the history of humans has been a history of the genetic manipulation of ourselves to get us all the different types of humans that we have, and of our domesticated animals and plants, which allow us to survive all over the world. And I will also add, although it's a little bit off topic for the course, but perhaps something interesting for you to think about and discuss, that it has also been accompanied by a certain amount of xenophobia, X-E-N-O-P-H-O-B-I-A, xenophobia, fear of strangers, whether it's somebody else's domesticated animals and plants, a little distrust perhaps of what those dogs are about or what sort of chickens those other folks are keeping, and also certainly a noticing of differences in ourselves with all of the results that go along with this, both negative and positive. So consider xenophobia also a little bit as part of the history of humans and the history of the genetic manipulation of ourselves and our animals and plants. So what was it that our human ancestors did not understand? What are the mechanisms behind the passing of traits from parent to offspring? It's all about the amazing and intricate and complicated workings of the information molecule DNA. And it was not until the last half of the 20th century that we began to get an understanding of how DNA works. And we still don't completely understand it. It's still a very exciting topic to read about. It's something that I enjoy opening my science journals every week or every month to see what's new with DNA and what is it that I don't know. So it's still a very exciting ongoing topic, very complicated. We're definitely going to touch on it in this course, but we're going to also follow along almost in the order in which things happened historically. That is, we'll begin with some relatively simple observations about genetic traits without bringing DNA into the picture at all, because that's really how it began. Okay, and then we will gradually bring DNA into the picture and then put everything together. That will be a goal for the course. I also want to say that one of the things that I'm hoping that you might come out of the course with is an understanding of enough of the basics of genetics that you'll have a little better an idea when you see a new story in genetics, a new story in current or modern genetics, that you have a little more of an idea about whether it's a complete new story, whether they seem to be leaving out some information or maybe glossing over some information or oversimplifying some aspect, and maybe a little bit better an idea of how to form some of your own particular judgments. Sometimes we're called upon to make ethical decisions, for example, concerning genetics. Can we do that with a little more of a foundation for what's behind some of the genetics that we're being asked to consider? What examples? Well, how about cloning? cloning occasionally comes up in respect to our ability now to clone, or what they're calling cloning, and I'll get into that particular nuance, but cloning pets. What if you had a pet who was about to die? Could you collect some cells from that pet? Could you then get that pet cloned? Well, the short answer turns out to be yes, there is a manipulation by which we can take cells from that pet and get them cloned, in a word, and we'll talk about that a little bit. What about stem cells? There's another topic in the news concerning genetics. What can we find out about stem cells by understanding the basics? We're also called on to understand something about the genetic modification of animals and plants, sometimes even abbreviated, genetic modification, GMO, right? Genetic modification of organisms. What can we understand about that? I'm hoping to give you a little bit of background on that as well. How about that argument that's sometimes called nature versus nurture, or nurture versus nature? We're going to address that in at least a couple of lectures. And then how about that word eugenics, which certainly has a great deal of accompanying controversy with it? We'll address that a little bit. And then the genetics of behavior, kind of a thorny topic, but with a lot of exciting things going on right now. And I'm hoping to put that a little bit into perspective for you. Evolution. Genetics is an absolute foundation of evolution. This will help you, I hope, to understand evolution a little bit better. And we'll have one particular lecture in which I will tell you much more about the particular aspect of genetics that supports evolution. How about conservation biology? We're sometimes called upon to preserve particular genetic varieties of organisms. What does that mean, to preserve a genetic variety of an organism or a particular, you know, group of organisms, as conservation biologists sometimes would like to have us do? In a sense, I want us to address these things by going back to our human ancestors' ownership of the basics and make them your basics too. And then we'll weave these bigger controversial topics in. We are going to end up with modern genetics, but we're going to start with Gregor Mendel, who was the first person to, in a very methodical way, make observations, record observations, and analyze observations about genetics, and thereby lay the foundation for what was going to be the rest of 20th century genetics. So we're going to begin with Gregor Mendel. In the next lecture, I want to begin with Mendel in the last part of the 19th century and tell you in some detail about what he did that was so amazing and what he did to essentially launch genetics as a scientific topic and not just something that was a practical topic for our human ancestors.
This ends Lecture 1. Please fast forward to the end before turning the cassette over.